I would like to call to order the Administrative Control Board meeting for Mountain Regional Water. It is March 19, 2026 at 6:01 p.m. Do we have any public input?
No one is online.
Okay. Do we need to go into executive session?
We do not.
Great. Okay. Does anyone have any questions on the February 19th minutes?
Couple things. Starting at the bottom, number six, just a misspelling of my name, which happens a lot. Autospell has a payday with it sometimes. And then on item four, it's more of a question. I don't know if I can remember the discussion, but about the very end of the that paragraph about the just the motor. Actually, you can see I keep going down right there, that last sentence. So it says replacements more than 10,000, but replacement will be 40,000. So maybe that follows the discussion, but those are the same thing. Like, I don't know if it needs clarified. I just wasn't sure if that was two different pieces of equipment.
So we,
it is,
it's a piece of surplus equipment that we sold for $1,000, but because the replacement value is greater than $10,000, the replacement was $40,000. We had to get the board's approval to surplus.
Oh, okay. We must
the piece of equipment
approval. Okay, I get it now.
So maybe we can clean
just
that up.
It so can, like even a comment in the sense. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. And then at the very, very end, under the signatures, a little blurb about the public meeting. Those months are keep going down. The months are incorrect. I read the fine print sometimes. Right?
Oh.
So you're talking about pursuant to the ADA?
Yeah. This is at meeting November 20th, 25.
We can have Anna make those changes now and then get them fixed before for signature. So we can approve it pending those changes if we want to use that comment.
Okay.
And how long have you been wrong?
Yes.
But just last year. So that'd just be how we did have a brief meeting. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then January approaches.
Does somebody use a motion to?
Somebody will make a motion for the whole consent agenda, but there are always questions on the check register.
So always.
Any questions on the check register? Nobody?
I actually don't.
Okay, I didn't have a whole lot, but I wondered why we had so many voided checks.
Oh, the printer jammed, and to get the sequence, because it's all posi pay where we send a file to Zions and check number and amounts have to match up.
Gotcha.
So when I jammed it, threw it off for several checks.
Okay. And then I had a couple questions on the credit card. Is the Everbridge charge a yearly charge?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Is that for all the meters, the clusters?
Everbridge, like a reverse 911 system, or it's a communication.
Okay. Emergency notification.
Gotcha. Okay. That's actually a question, too.
And then did SB Weird have a cyber incident?
Yeah, I'm not thinking about it right now, so I couldn't tell you what the ins and outs of it were.
It just looked like somebody had lunch to talk about.
Oh, yes. So they did have an incident, and then Chris and Caden wanted to understand, because we both use ETS, they wanted to understand responses. One of the water bills that passed this year was related to cybersecurity. So once we're notified of an incident, we have to report into a state database within 2 hours of notification of that. And so right. we're just trying to learn.
Did anyone else have any questions on the check register or the credit card? Then we have two purchase orders, one for H2O Innovation for a small $4.2 million, and then Wright Buildings for $73,901. So my question is, what does CIP stand for on the change version?
So the change order is for another heater in the CIP tank, which is clean in place, is the acronym.
Okay.
So whenever we do a chemical or enhanced cleaning of the membranes, we mix a recipe in the CIP tank, which is pumped through the membranes to clean them.
This PO for H2O is suspenders and belt and suspenders. You originally approved a $250,000 design fee. This change order increases the amount of the contract. The amount of money that Mountain Region will have to be paying directly is the $250,000 design fee. This contract actually ends up going to a contractor, but because we haven't selected a contractor, we're kind of in limbo of where should this fall. So as an abundance of caution, we're asking for you to approve this amount, if that makes sense.
And so the 4.1 million membranes, like how long do they last? Is this?
So this like, is the
this these will be for the new building.
This is for
right?
the, correct. This is for the new building. I don't know if we know what the life of the membrane will be. I know the ones that we have now, each modular lasting about 7 years or less. What we're
okay.
Yeah, and this is for a lot more than just the membranes. This is the hall loop piping.
Check it out.
Yeah, it's not only the skid, but the all the other changes the plant will have to do for those membranes and things like that, if I'm not mistaken, Sam. Right.
Yeah. So the module themselves, 10 years in their gold state spring. So, yeah, this is all the hardware, cleaning equipment, compressors, pumps, everything necessary to push the water through the skids. So it's a little bit of a unique arrangement where we procured a membrane supplier ahead of a general contract.
Yeah.
But from a design perspective, it's really helpful because we have a solid design going into the plant expansion. So it's just really clean from a design perspective and takes a lot. Previously, we did a PO just for the design submittals, which were, like Annie said, $275,000. But we just thought, since this is a change order, it'll be part of the larger project budget. $40 million. It's essentially a contingency item, just to be transparent, we'll bring it to the board to sign the change order, even though Mountain Region will never directly pay that expense. The contractor will pay it. After a contractor is selected, and this contract is assigned a decision.
Okay. So he pays us back, but this looks like we're signing a purchase order.
Why we use a purchase order? That's kind of Steve's role.
Yeah. Authorized. Because we'd signed the contract with them, but we just thought, you know, we are committing to money, so we should make sure it's part of the whole WIPIA, $38 million, the whole treatment plants. But since we're making this commitment, we should make sure the board is aware of it. Because also when we do get the contractor who's actually going to do the whole build and things like that, you'll sign the contract and probably a PO, just because there's not a – it just makes sure we're covered both ways. For whoever's going to build the buildings and excavate and do all of that kind of work too.
Once the general contractor has been chosen, we'll enter into that portion. This contract then flips to the general contractor. It's a unique situation where we will ultimately pay this, but we're not directly paying this amount. I know it.
Did we budget for this $4 million?
Oh yeah. It's part of the bigger budget. But because the change order is happening now before we've awarded the contract to the general contractor, in order for H2O to keep going, we're approving the change order.
Is it that make sense?
Is it like a reassignment of contract?
This will be.
And then the...
It doesn't make sense.
And we won't pay it. We won't pay it now.
We won't. No, we won't pay it directly to H2O. We will pay it to the general contractor who then in turn pays. So at some time over the next 2 years.
The portion we will pay directly is the $275,000.
Which isn't changing.
Which isn't changing. That's the original PO you signed. That's what we will pay directly to them. And it's actually in this number too. But then once it flips over, actually doing the work, not just the design work, then it goes to the contract.
All right, now I'm confused.
Okay.
I thought I had it, but.
Oh, I should have kept my mouth shut.
Yep.
Back in October, November, I can't remember.
The 200 is not in this.
The 275 is. So if you go down to the notes, it explains, not there, just in the notes on the PO, that this includes the 275,000. Because that's the total contract amount. The only portion we will pay directly is the 275.
About $4 million of this is going to transfer over to them.
Yeah. To the CMGC or wherever the contract.
The PO is basically kind of like a bid, kind of like an estimation change.
Yes, exactly. And that just became apparent, like, well, as long as we're changing that, we should give them the whole number. So out of the budget we've already set up through the capital budgeting process last year, that is include this whole $4 million as part of that. We're not asking for $4 million new. It's just kind of like, now we know where this $4 million is going. And then we'll know later where $20 million is going. That makes sense.
Okay. And why are we doing PO now?
Because they had a change order. So these two lines, the 56 and 31, changed the original amount they thought. So we thought, well, we could have them just approve the change order, but that kind of doesn't make sense since they haven't seen the original amount. So we wanted you to see the original.
And that way they can keep going along with the design. Otherwise, we would delay them until next, or the end of this year or the beginning of next year.
Why can't they take this PO?
Who?
Contractor.
We haven't assigned it yet. We haven't awarded the general contract for that.
Yeah. Whoever bids and wins the contract has to accept this contract as part of them contracting with us.
Yeah, an existing contract, H2O Innovation, the membrane supplier, one of the executed specifications is a reassignment specification to assign this existing contract to them. So it's a small change order for the whole project cost and the choosing to present it as a purchase order.
Yeah.
Then it's just all in one place.
Sure.
Yeah. And that doesn't change order. You just combine the two.
So the change order is the 87, roughly?
Yeah. But the entire contract's the 4.2. So we just wanted to show you. That's that 600-page document from October.
But we're only going to pay about four of them.
We're only going to pay the
Sorry. 275.
275 is what we're going to pay. The contractor's going to pay the four.
Yeah.
Correct. We ultimately pay.
Yeah. It'll all be our money. It's just who will handle it to who.
Messy.
The timing thing, though, which it kind of have to do to keep them H2O.
Does anyone have any more questions on that one? Does anyone have any questions on the other one for the Wright building?
Other than where is that?
Did
you go to the intake with Chris?
Not yet.
Okay, so it's down at by our cabin.
Okay.
In what we call Peola.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's still part of the district? Because that was my question, that it was in Camas. And I was like, what?
It's right near the intake. Where the Lost Canyon. Have you ever been to the cabin? Not too long road trip.
The big pump station?
The intake or the cabin?
What's that?
It's at the intake or the cabin?
It's close. It's next door to the cabin.
What's the building for?
So we have had problems with rats and other things, so it's a place to secure equipment.
Gavin used to have a garage tech thing we tore down, and this is kind of a replacement.
Because we keep skid steer and some other equipment.
The rats have gotten in and eaten wiring and...
Need a cat.
Not my adrenaline.
We're not taking care of
them.
Does anyone have any other questions on the consent agenda?
Motion to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
Okay.
Does this have to be as noted
per the changes still recommended to the
right per
minutes.
The changes? Okay. I think yes. Anna's updating that. So all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That's unanimous. Okay. Steve, what do you have for us for February?
February was a we're slightly over on our revenue projection so far through February. We're over because of impact fees.
I'm over here. I'm
so sorry. Inspection fees and some interest earnings.
Yeah, right here.
We're actually under, so we're over the 36.
Oh, where's the little pointer?
Right.
Oh, yes. This is new.
Don't blow anybody's eye out.
Yeah. Okay. So we're overall revenue were $36,000 above budget. Expenses were $156,000, or $192,000 better than budget through February. Most of it is from expense savings. Sam, if you want to go down to like the next table. So as I was saying, water sales is actually under budget because usage has been quite low for January, February. There just hasn't been people in town. But Park City Wheeling's basically right on budget. Development-related collections, these are impact fees, meter installs, they're a little over, and other revenue. We have gotten a couple of large inspection fees in for the promontory, and also interest earnings is still running a little better because I'm still sitting on a little bit of construction cash we didn't spend. Okay, let's go down to the next table. Oh, yeah, sorry, real quick. So residential water sales out of this number was actually the most negative, 7.9% of our budget because our usage was down 7%, about 1.33 million gallons in February. So again, just showing people aren't in their second homes or things like that. All right, let's go ahead and go down. Expenses. So overall, we're up 72.2% on expenses compared to last year. But you'll notice a big piece of that is depreciation, that we're a lot higher in depreciation. And that's the fact that we've added so many assets during 2025. But if you back that out, our actual operating expenses are only about 3.4%. Stem, can you go up just a little bit? I can't remember. Yeah, 3.4 if you take out depreciation. So right kind of where you'd expect expenses to be increasing at. And then let's go down to the next table. So cash in January and February, you'll see we did spend a lot of that other restricted. That was construction cash came basically up to this. We reimbursed ourselves. So restricted cash became available cash for us to use. And we also finally had a month when you signed the check registers, or if you all saw that, we only spent like $550,000 plus payroll. That's the lowest we've had in a long, long time. So we didn't go through much cash, and we had some other collections. Park City and UOP had kind of gotten behind in December and January, but we got their payments in February, so that helped bump cash too. Customer growth. So if you recall, and I kind of mentioned up there, in January we only had one new impact fee for $6,590. February we rebounded nicely. We got 11. For about 70,000, 77,000. So we're back up above budget. So that was good to have the rebound in February. Promontory kind of also rebounded. They had one, they had three. So customer growth was looking better in February than it was in January. Let's go down to the usage one. So this is the, we were 5.1% down on all of our direct customers over the five-year average, basically from 73 acre feet to 69, 73 last year to 69. Again, commercial was down, but not as much as residential, let's say. And then, thank you.
Why is Summit Waters no usage this year?
Because we don't have a contract with them for this year. It's part of the regionalization, and we've been wheeling them water up until this year, and we're giving our, basically, we were kind of phasing out as our own customers were growing. Mm-hmm. So these are the years we kind of phase out. It will come back on once the treatment plant is done. We put water back on the table to wheel to them. But for now, we won't have any this year.
Okay.
Next 2-3 years, 26, 27, 28, is back on the table in 29.
Okay.
This is a little sidebar related. Do we anticipate them actually buying water from us in the future, or will they continue to buy from Park City Municipal? Park City costs more.
Yeah, their expense structure is a little different than ours. We will probably, ours is going up because of the treatment plant, but we will make sure it works out so that they'll want to buy a little bit
from us. We are contracted to sell them water in Weaver Waste and Water in 2029 and 2030.
Yeah.
Once the treatment
plan. Have we determined how much?
Yes.
It's
nominal.
Less than 200 acre feet.
Yeah.
I think we talked about this kind of. What if we don't finish the treatment plant project on time and that water?
We've given ourselves enough of a cushion.
Okay. We can even do it if it doesn't.
Yeah, it's got to snow between.
Yeah.
But yeah, treatment plant should be done sometime in 28. We don't have any commitment until 29. And so we've tried to give ourselves. Okay. All right, let's go down to just real quick. So the graph, so the blue, like that was kind of expected in January. We're a little tighter to last year. There should have been a little bit higher, but again, because of the decreased usage, we weren't quite there. And then the next one just shows that where we really, this was surprisingly where it was. Everything else was pretty tight. Like I said, commercial was a little down and things like that, but everything else was pretty tight to budget. But yeah, commercial just, you think you've got 3% growth, you're going to use normal water. Those don't happen. And that's what happens to the budget. But again, really early in the year, but we're still ahead of budget. So, all right.
Were you going to say something on Park City Wheeling?
Oh, just that. Yeah, that's, theirs is very predictable because so much of it is basically base because it's only expenses beyond that. All the other is kind of a set fee. So, I don't take too much credit for that other than we should be that close kind of thing. The reason I highlight that is because it's not in the graph, the next graph down, or in the graph above, sorry. All right. Let's see what else. I've got a WIFIA update, update.
WIFIA. Mm-hmm.
Okay, WIFIA. I think Andy, let you all know we did close the loan. The rate on it is 4.88%. We lost a couple of basis points as the market was going up, but we got that in at that rate. So still very happy about it. We've been transitioned to their new team who will handle everything. We had a first call with her. I think it's going to go really well. She seems very cooperative and is really looking to help us. There'll be a little more requirements like quarterly reports during construction and things like that, but still, I think was a really good move by the district overall to get this project going and not have payments for 5 years after substantial completion. The audit.
I have another question.
Yeah.
Is that going to affect our interest rate for our bond refinancing?
It shouldn't, because when we did our ratings are you talking? The market is going to impact
our Bank of Utah.
Of Utah. The savings we presented during February was based on a low, looks like a dip now. We're a pretty low part. We're back up
to a higher rate, we probably lost about 20 basis points.
Yeah.
And so we're still going to move forward to get the parameters approved with Summit County Council next week, but we may not be quite as aggressive in refinancing it as soon. We're hoping something will resolve and maybe those rates will start to come down.
Okay.
Because that would get locked in like in a couple months though, right? Like April or something?
Well, as soon as you go to the bond market, so we were originally targeting meeting with S&P and Fitch the end of this month, very beginning of April, and potentially going to market, a week or two after that.
Yeah, gotcha.
And now it's like, well, maybe we were kind of pushing it, and now we're like, let's back off a little bit. So we don't get, because once you get a rating from Fitch and S&P, it's only good for 90 days. So if we wanted to wait more than 90 days, we potentially have to go back to them. So these are all the things that we're kind of contemplating right now. But yeah, we are, the 2.8 million net present value savings we had during February is still above 2 million, but not that high above 2 million. So still we'd save money, but might wait till we might save more money again. Audit update, auditors will be here next Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Oakland finally got us the final pay app this morning, which was really nice because I was able to finally, create all the assets and do some final entries that I needed to make to be able to roll everything up. So, so I think that's it for me, unless there's any questions. Happy to answer anything. Okay.
All right. Does anyone have any other questions on Steve's report? Okay, we are on to the consideration for recommendation of approval to the Summit County Council, acting as the governing body of the district, additional proposed changes to the district personnel.
Yes, so you approved the changes we proposed last meeting, and since that time, we had two additional small recommendations we'd like to make for changes. One is just adding the word employee before clothing allowance to make that really clear that that's an employee clothing allowance and not for anything else. And then we also wanted to clarify that if an employee elects to take paid time off to extend their separation date, the hours available to that employee would be 80% of the hours earned, which would be the same as if you were doing a lump sum payout. It's 80% of the hours earned. The way our current policy reads, that's a little bit confusing. So we wanted to tighten that up a little bit just to say, if you're going to separate from the district, your sick time is either paid out at 80% or you can use 80% of those hours to extend your separation date. So those were the two changes.
It's 80% of the paid time off.
Correct.
Hours.
Total PTO hours.
But they have banked.
Yeah. Only what they've earned. Any questions? We would be incorporating these two changes with the policies that are going to County Council on Wednesday of next week.
I might be ignorant on this, but I was always under the impression that vacation time was considered earned wages and had to be paid out at 100% upon separation for the state of Utah.
Vacation time does.
Sick time
does not.
So PTO,
now that we're going to PTO.
When you go to PTO, although it's all PTO, you actually still have to keep track of how much sick leave you brought into it.
Yeah. And we have that in the policy. People who have the sick will stay in a separate bank, that old sick that we talked about last time. That doesn't change. That still gets paid out of the old policy. But anything new will be paid out at 80%. And we're following the county's policy. So if that 80%, first time I've heard of that. You can't, you have to pay.
I could be wrong on that, but that's been my understanding.
I remember saying that vacation has to be paid out.
So you're going to track how much vacation sick is in the PTO?
No.
Or is sick going in?
Like everything's going in at a one-to-one, except for those who had 100% payout of sick, which we have three employees who had that whole sick balance that so we're like currently tracking separately, correct. So, but everybody else is going to get a one-for-one ratio of their sick and vacation into PTO. So it will no longer be called vacation, and it will be called PTO.
And the 80% only applies to the sick time that's going in, it's carried over, or everything moving forward?
Everything moving forward will be converted to this new policy.
But there's that was your question.
That was, yeah, and I, that's the first time, the county is currently using that policy of 80% payout, so.
Ian, we have four employees that are grandfathered mm-hmm. that will receive 100% of their sick.
You said. I can look into it for you.
If it's aligned with the county, I'm fine with it. Mm-hmm. Do their HR.
So we do need a motion.
Yeah, so somebody would like to make a motion.
I'll make a motion to approve the two changes to the policy being sent to the county for review.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. It's unanimous. Lisa, tell us about the Water Supply Commission's update and the legislative update.
I just had a brief memo and some slides in your packet. The slides are just a compilation of slides we've seen over the past few weeks from Weaver Basin and Utah Drought Call that we do biweekly. I did add this slide. This just came out today. This is the current drought monitor.
Yeah, none of it was rosy.
Yeah, it was just coming back from the Utah Water Users Conference this week. I mean, I was pretty concerned. Usually I go down there and I feel a little bit better, but I came back feeling worse. So this didn't change that much. You can see from last week, slightly changed, not a lot. I think the one that comes out next week, it's going to be pretty significantly different. The temperatures that we're seeing obviously are very high, and we're setting records at this point, and we're not just set, we're shattering records is what I've heard people say. So these really, really dry temperatures are kind of deteriorating the soil moisture content that we did have. So if you just keep going down, that was just February. That was February. That wasn't even March. I don't even know what March is going to look like, but that's just the difference. I mean, we're just bright red. If you look at the forecasts for the next 8 to 14 days, it's that red, and it literally is sitting right over Utah, like deep, dark red. Sorry, Sam, can you just keep going? That was just a comparison of the snowpack over the last 3 years and really the decrease that we've seen year over year. The spring transition outlook at this point in time, when this was from the Utah Climate Center a few weeks ago, it could kind of go either way, but we're definitely seeing temperatures climbing in the wrong direction. So keep going. Again, temperatures high, precipitation equal chances, but that's moved to more below precipitation or less precipitation than they were anticipating. The spring outlook, yeah, you can see a little bit more of that red, the darker or orange, I guess, creeping into the seasonal precipitation outlook. It's not looking good for the spring, and high temperatures. Going down, our snowpack, we've definitely dipped. You can see that's the state of Utah then you can see we've gone down into record setting lows there. Keep going down. I think I have one. This is just Weber Base. This is just our Weber Ogden. You can see we had a large stretch below. We've crept back up into a little bit of higher territory, but that was on March 9th, and we're coming back down now. And the peak snowpack, the peak squeeze usually there, that green X, that's usually around the beginning of April. We've already peaked with our snowpack around that date of March 9th, they're saying. So we peaked a month early, which is pretty incredible. Keep going down. They were thinking we were going to get a 64%. I can't remember if it was, I guess it was Jordan yesterday that was saying, we're not even looking at 50% on these predictive models. We're going with more like a 70%. So you're looking at one of those orange lines where we're probably going to end up going forward. Again, more record-setting lows likely to come. Precipitation, again, because we've had it in the form of rain, has been pretty much close to average. But again, in the form of rain and not snow. And that's Weber Ogden area. Keep going down. Soil moisture, like I said, has been high just because we've got rain instead of snow, and normally it should be flatlining this time of the year. Keep going down. Reservoir levels, 68%. I want to say that was a little bit lower when we were just at the Water Users Conference. Some of the projections they were slowing. While we are better than we were in the last drought cycle that we went through, and it's slightly higher than a median for this time, it's still 12% below last year. So we're eating into any savings that we have. Keep going down.
And it doesn't affect us, but Paul's probably going to ask for the upper base to sit down. The red spars, similar to last summer.
Yeah.
I mean, where it could be artificially dumping water.
Yeah, we went to a talk on that. Not super happy. No. They want to keep as much inflaming orange as they can, but I don't know. I mean,
it could be a, but Paul should be a power tool.
I know. That's what they're saying by December.
Yeah. So,
this is just the Weber storage, Wanship and Rockport and Echo. We're a little bit below on the Wanship. A little bit right where we are, and I echo, keep going down. This was an interesting slide. The elevation's important. They were saying that mostly above 8,500 is at 75% normal. A lot of the talk at the conference was everything above 9,000 is fairly normal, but anything below 9,000 is significantly below normal. So, I mean, it's pretty much see that with your looking out the window. Keep going down. So Weber Basin's recommendation when we went and talked to them last week, right now is a 20% reduction. So that would be 20% reduction for our M&I culinary outdoor water irrigation. They're not asking for any reductions to indoor water right now. I did check in with John Perry this morning at Weber Basin just to see if they had any thoughts after water users in these warm temperatures. He said they're still going with 20% to their board meeting, which is March 26th. That's where they'll approve, Weber Basin will approve their drought recommendation. But that doesn't mean things can't change if the spring ends up being very dry and very hot. Those could go more from the moderate to severe drought categories. So we also talked with Clint while we were down there. I've been talking to Park City. We just all want a message on the same.
What does that mean to us when Weber Basin makes these recommendations?
So if you go down one more slide. So we are aligned with Weber Basin's drought response levels. These are the district's drought response levels. So right now they're indicating moderate, so we would be indicating a moderate, that 20% demand reduction outside.
How do we apply that? Like, I know it's a recommendation, but how do we do that?
So we're going to use the technology that we have with Badger, and we're going to monitor. We're not going to allow people to water every day. We want people with even addresses to water, even days, odd on odd days, and we're gonna clamp down this summer.
Is it through like fines or things or policing? Or
there are things in our policies. The rates will be adjusted based on the drought recommendation, but we do have things in our policies that allow us to go after water wasting and things like that. We don't want to put ourselves in this situation, yeah. But we got to do what we got to do.
Yeah, we think we can use, and we're already starting to message to customers, and we're trying to get some messaging going early for those customers that we saw last year that were watering every day, because that's clearly against our policy. Sure. You shouldn't be watering every day. So we're trying to hit those customers.
And the board gets deputized. Mm-hmm. So that's, you get to go out and...
So yes, and we can see a lot of that, and we were talking about setting up reports in Badger to just be able to see on a daily basis who's been watering, you know, over a 48 hour period consistently. And making sure we're contacting those. And we do the first is a warning, and then we go to more severe violations, which become monetary.
Okay.
In 2022, when this last happened, between our rates and messaging and things like that, we were actually able to drive usage down.
Okay.
So it's usually pretty successful, especially since it appears there'll be statewide messaging.
Yeah.
That helps a lot.
I'm just thinking if we do hit another response level where it gets even more drastic.
There are some water districts down at the conference were saying they put an orifice in the meter pit that literally restricts.
They can't run sprinklers, basically.
Yeah. You know, they get very minimal. We're not there yet.
During the last response, we had certain users that just kept going throughout.
Yeah, and they paid for it. I mean, and that's the balance. I mean, we still need to generate revenue, but we can find other ways to generate revenue. We just can't find other ways to create water.
Expenses.
That's part of it, too.
Yeah, that's what I...
is making sure that we're being mindful, not only asking our customers to be, but also tightening our belts as well, and making sure that we're trying to do everything we can to keep expenses down. So this is just, where we are right now. We will do a more formal presentation and ask for a recommendation at the April board meeting.
Lisa, I'm sorry I interrupted you. You were saying... You spoke with Clint.
Yep, I just talked to Clint too. We just want to be on the same page as a community when we're messaging so that we're not giving different signals from different water companies. So Summit County is looking to do a community outreach talk speaker series here in May. That might also be a good time. If you remember last year, the last drought cycle we went through when we had to institute drought rates, all the water providers got together and did a presentation and invited the public to attend to let them know what we were doing, a little bit about our systems. And we were based in this area. We were based and will also be at this one. But again, we're just trying to collectively message together so that there's confusion.
Do we have any rain barrels?
Yeah, we don't have any rain barrels left, but we are participating in the rain barrel program again, and that kicks off next week. And the distribution will be at our new facility, which is nice. We have a covered area to keep the rain barrels rather than doing it out at Quinn's. So we are partnering with Park City Municipal and the county, Summit County, on doing that. Yeah. So any other questions on
I thought it was interesting that the governor came in yesterday and said that he wasn't going to recommend anything. Is it just that he's waiting for April to happen, or?
I don't know.
It's
not
like City came out some today.
Yeah.
And expected the state to do the same thing.
I know when we were down at Water Users, when he declares an emergency, right now, correct me if I'm wrong, Steve or Andy, but I believe it's a 30-day. It can only last for 30 days. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be mindful of when you pull that trigger, because that does open yourself up it opens the state up for federal assistance. So what I was hearing down there was that is an option. And they're just trying to decide when that timing might be. And maybe they're just waiting to see how the next few weeks and maybe next month or so go before they make a declaration. That's it on that. The legislative update. Okay. So I had it behind my department summary here. I just kind of summarized a few of the bills that passed and that didn't. Nothing really significant as far as Mountain Regional goes. There is one that we'll get into, SB 284, that we've talked a little bit about with Dave. This first page, HB 19, drinking water utility amendments. This requires a community water system. Andy was talking about this earlier, to complete an emergency response plan, which we already have, but not all systems do, and to report a breach to the Utah cybersecurity within 2 hours of us finding out. We need to alert them within 2 hours. Some people thought that 2 hours was a little too aggressive, but they ended up landing on the 2 hours. So basically, as soon as we know, we need to let the Utah Cyber Center know. HB 69, this is drinking water restructuring amendments. This gives the Division of Drinking Water some additional tools to help intervene if they have a non-compliant public water system. This is really, they talked about it being a tool of last resort. They don't want to go around court appointing a receivership of water entities. But really, if water systems are not listening to the Division of Drinking Water, if they have compliance issues, this just gives them another tool to take over that system and make sure it becomes compliant. HB 296 permits a commitment of available water to uses on the Great Salt Lake to be included in your conservation plan. So that was just kind of making that, putting the Great Salt Lake in a little bit more light there. SB 284 was interesting. That was how some of the language that came in that last six sub, there were a lot of subs that went through this one. It was just a municipal bill, and then in the very end, they took some language from HB 439 that I thought was dying and threw it into SB 284. So this initially, this water exactions was just dealing with municipalities, but they expanded the scope to deal with not only municipalities, but also counties and special service districts. There's a lot in this bill. I can't remember how many pages. It's like 100 or 200 pages or something. But the one thing that it does talk about is water exactions. So this requires counties, municipalities, and special districts to adopt a written plan to determine future water needs before imposing a water exaction. And a water exaction is basically water rights. The actual plan that they're requiring is something that I think we already have a lot of, something close to that already. They haven't decided what that actually looks like. That will come from the state engineer. They will put parameters around what will actually need to be included in that written plan. It's my understanding right now, you have for future planning purposes, not all entity is the same, and it's not consistent across counties and municipalities. So they're trying to make that a more consistent document. So the state engineer is working on getting guidelines to us on what that plan needs to look like and what needs to go in there. And before we can impose any type of water exaction on a future development, we would need to have that plan. So that's SB 284. Go to the next slide. These are just a few others that happened. The data center water transparency amendment. We're really trying to wrap their heads around these large data centers and how much water these things are going to be consuming. So they've set a kind of a definition of a large data centers is 75 acre feet or more per year in at least one facility greater than 10,000 square feet. And they must notify the Division of Water Rights and Quality in the planning phase and the local water supplier at least 90 days before construction. So again, just trying to get some more transparency on what the water requirements are going to be for those systems. Water-wise landscaping, and the SB 246 and SB 252 deal more with state agencies
and trying to be more water wise in their planning, and limiting those areas of non-functional turf, and then also trying to use that water wise landscaping going forward when they're constructing new facilities. And they have in SB 252, they're asking the Division of Facilities and Construction Management to actually conduct audit of the irrigation systems to get them more efficient, so they're not watering or doing overhead spray watering during the middle of the day. The Colorado River was also one that came up a little bit during this session. They changed where the Colorado River Authority resides. It used to be in the governor's office, and now it's going to the Department of Natural Resources. It amended some membership to include the can't remember, it's the Water Conservancy District down south, which is, I can't remember.
In Washington County.
Washington County Conservancy District, yes. And they made some other changes to expand the powers. But again, as you've heard, they did not come to an agreement, the upper and lower basin states. So it now, the federal government is stepping in. They are apparently still trying to work with each other, and I can't remember the date off the top of my head on where they're trying to land to find some way to work it out. But if they can't, the federal government's going to come in and tell them how to run that system. So I think they're just maybe a little bit ramping up for that. They also, again, a concurrent resolution addressing the Great Salt Lake. This is basically, it discussed the importance of the Great Salt Lake and its decline and encouraged the federal government to step in and provide assistance. There was some talk in the media recently over the past month about the federal government providing assistance. So apparently this concurrent resolution kind of sets the stage to help that federal government funding potentially come to light. Next. Other two that passed, these are just interesting. The data privacy amendment, we've been going through, and you've seen it in my notes, the privacy documentation that we've been doing. HB 450, it went through 5 subs. That restructures some of that original legislation that was passed, and I think we're going to probably continue to see that be revised as every legislative session goes on. So again, I'm just going to continue to work with Summit County to make sure that we're up to date on what we need to be doing. It sounds like Dave's office now has a dedicated person just doing data privacy.
She's doing more than just data privacy. Okay. She is the data privacy officer.
Okay, so they have a dedicated data privacy officer, so continue to work with her. And then I mentioned, I think, last time about state employees going on to PTO, and they did establish a PTO program. They aren't pushing it down to all of their employees. They're extending it to new employees and those that elect to participate. But again, just kind of shows that most agency or a lot of agencies lately are moving in that PTO direction from the vacation and sick separate. One more slide really quick, just some of the bills that didn't pass this time. HB 13 talked about limits to what we could charge on interest on past due balances to 7 to 10%. We currently charge 18. That did not pass. So we're still going with our 18%. There was some water loss study amendments and some water use modification amendments, kind of looking for those tiered rates, requiring those tiered rates, wanting to study water loss. Those also did not get through as those were all filed. It's kind of disappointing sometimes some of these things that look like really good bills that I think could do some good, but they don't get a lot of traction. Let's see, HB 489 limit. HB 501, that was the one that we talked a little bit last time. That was building on how we were going to fund these UWIP projects, the Utah Water Infrastructure Projects. And they were looking at magi of counties and trying to tie that 1.5% magi to a funding mechanism in order to collect the dollars at the local level, and the money would stay at the local level. They had went through many iterations of this and they couldn't come to a consensus. So again, this is another one that has been filed. It will definitely come back because they need to find a mechanism in order to fund these water infrastructure projects. But that didn't get passed in this legislative session. So I think that was it. Like I said, nothing really earth-shattering as far as the district. Really, it's just the water exactions, and then we'll continue to track that, how we're going to fund the water infrastructure projects.
Oops. Thanks.
Sure.
I always like the legislative, you know, happens so fast. Right?
Oh my gosh, it's so fast.
Okay, Andy, what do you
have? So after our last meeting, when the 60% design costs were up higher than anticipated, we met with Carollo, and we believe that there was some double counting done in the numbers. So we believe there's about $2.5 million worth of savings that aren't real savings, but we believe that number is $2.5 million lower than was presented. We also had a discussion with Promontory related to the irrigation system being moved out of the treatment plant. Our position is that that expense should be covered 100% by Promontory, so that would be another $600,000 reduction on the treatment plant. So we're down about $3.1 million from what was presented. There was also discussion at the meeting about trying to avoid double-digit rate increases. So Steve's worked his magic and has a couple of different scenarios based on the information that we know today. Of course, we don't have final numbers, but Steve's going to just walk through two different scenarios based on the numbers.
Because I keep that back too soon. So before we get into this, I just want to point out a couple of things. So in 2025, our residential customers, we received $10.6 million in revenue from that. On average, $5,423 for the year. So annual bill amount, that 1960, or monthly, about 163. It was interesting, because I want to go back and look 7 years ago, and our residential customers generated about $5.29 million. 3,500 of them, annual amounts, $123.43. So basically from 2018 to 2025, they saw a 32% increase in what they were paying. Okay, so with that background, so we had about a 52% growth since 2018 in customers, 1,851 customers, to go from 3,572 to 4,323. So you take our average bill right now, and we have a, when I run the model, it's kind of a key of hitting a number out in 2033, because that's when our payments kick in on the book. We don't need big rate increases in these years because our debt isn't increasing. We just need enough to cover increasing expenses. So they could have been as low as 4%. But then it could leave us with a balloon type payment or increase at the end. That is probably not the the best scenario to go about this. The other way is to start with another rate increase higher and keep that going. Because as you see, you end up at roughly the same spot in 2033. All these will matter a little bit on growth, what usage patterns do. So if our customers saw a 32% increase in their bills from 18 to 2025, from 2026 to 2033, they'll probably see about a 48 to 49% increase to their bills to get us to be where we need to make all the payments we're going to start making. So, I mean, we're a little early, but wanted to show you that we can definitely do it without double-digit rate increases, but we do need to start sooner and start to get people used to paying a little bit more so that by the time we get out here, we're okay. So, and just as a quick, if we just applied that straight along base So this year, everybody's paying $74.50 for one billing unit in their base. So by the 2033, you know, it's 111, 112 type of scenario. So like I said, not insurmountable, but it does require us just being consistent with that 6 to 6.5% rate increases. Again, kind of early, but I would recommend what we're seeing with usage patterns and drought, things like that. This probably 6% probably needs to be equal across all tiers, or in other words, it will probably need to hit base and tier one and tier two. We pushed a lot of our rate increase last year into the higher tiers, but I'm just not sure we can count on that going forward as much. So I think probably, and then we can play with that going through these years if we kind of go back to the mainly across flat increase across all base and tiers. Maybe this one's a little more conservation minded and kind of establish our pattern. But that, so we'll get there, but that's what it'll take.
So this 6% is what you would recommend for when we,
when we decide,
look at it in December.
Based on the information that we know today, at 60%. Yeah. Hopefully we can refine that at 90%. Hopefully the contract will come in under what, you know, the engineer estimate is. But there are two paths that we could potentially go down to keep rate increases low and then do double digit in 2033 or just keep them below. This is also assuming we don't have any major capital improvement that we have to do. That's just based on what we know today.
This is just for the water treatment plant.
Water treatment plant and other operating expenses.
This will spin off money for other capital projects because part of how we have to hit that 1.25, so we have to hit 125% of our expenses. The 25% goes to capital projects. That will still go to those. This is just so we can make the debt payment in 2033. So we won't be not, we'll still be able to do stuff. It won't be like we can't do any other capital projects. We probably, what Eddie's referring to is we couldn't go and pull $5 million project and need to do that or something like that. It'd be more like the $2 million we normally do every year, you know, $1 million big one, a $500,000 and several little ones will probably be the pattern for the next couple of years in addition to the treatment plan.
But unless we have another big capital project, then we wouldn't foresee rate increases after this.
They should fall back to just to match expenses. So more that 3 to 4%, more like inflation. Until we would need to, quote unquote, borrow money again for another big project.
If such a thing. And remind me, what's our forecast for the upgrade to the treatment plant? Gets us to where with build out? When do we hit?
It should get, well, based on what we know as build out,
which includes Dakota Pacific. Does it? I was thinking backwards.
We created our master plan, we made the decision to only forecast within annexed areas of the district.
900 something units is not.
No. I think it's a defensible way to do it. You could argue the other side. At some point.
I think you guys did the right thing. I'm just trying to process where we're at.
Then, you know, we start thinking about launch it. We start some accounting, like where to draw the line.
Have you run that sensitivity, though? I mean, it seems like Dakota Pacific's happening. I mean,
it seems like, yeah, we should. A little bit of a tangent, but we should. Do like a brief amendment to our master plan.
Or, I mean, just as like a side project, just an Excel sensitivity. Like, when do we hit to build out with Dakota Pacific coming in as well? Like, when do we run out of water for growth?
Yeah, I would accelerate that. Without Dakota Pacific, without doing this exercise, the plan essentially gets us to growth.
Which is what year?
Well, the master plan goes up to 2065, but when you look at the projections, kind of one of the big improvements, I think, to the master plan is the growth happens much more rapidly, you know, in the middle of the growth period. And as we approach build-out, growth declines because it's harder to build out a mature district, which makes sense for some of the work. Laws get harder and harder. That's an extreme example.
Although I keep getting proven wrong.
Yes. I can put 50 columns.
So, so we put much less emphasis on trying to predict what's happening next year, 2 years, even though Steve got pretty good at it.
And he is good at it.
Yeah. But now we just think of it more of a, you know, mathematical term, and logistic. We're going to see a lot. The majority of growth happens right now. We're in the middle of the numbers reflect that. I mean, as we reach maturity closer to 65. The rate of growth will decline. So I remember your question.
So yes,
you answered it.
And then
just when roughly we hit both buildings.
We're drilling our test well.
Yep.
This summer. We're doing the ASR project in Atkinson.
We took credit for the well, right? In our master plan.
Didn't we have
a new well in there?
Yes.
Yep.
But yeah, the well and the treatment plant combined.
Yep.
Essentially, again, it's projection. It's meant to cover a wide range of outcomes.
Yeah,
but looking at the upcoming future, well, and the treatment plant should essentially.
So that's our goal for importation project. 2065.
Or never.
Yes, when we're long gone. But I think there's other things in the basin that we could do. I think Spring Creek Springs is a, you know, if there's treatment that would happen over there, it would be another source of water that would be less expensive.
This feels painful. Everything else is more painful.
Yep. Importation.
That's good. Steve, how sensitive is this to interest rates?
Not really right now, because we've locked in with Whippia. We know what the payments will be. They could only get better because we've got our 4.88% locked.
On how much money?
On $38 million.
And so we're still $12
million. Well, we financed. We've already put in about 3.5% of our own money, kind of towards our 20%. So 38 plus 20%, you know, so we're really projecting about 46, 47 million because we're back below 50 because these guys found 3.1. So we're more in the high 40s when it's all said and done. So we're really not subject to interest rates anymore.
And we still need to borrow some
money. We may, but we don't have to go do that right now because we can cover a lot with the 38 million and we'll just have to go get more money. For example, if when we go out to bid, we find out the project is going to be, we'll know this dollar amount. Then we can do the math of, okay, how much cash we're going to generate? How much is the loan? Do we need to go get another 3 to 4 million? Whereas before we were talking 7, 7.5 million we'd have to go get. But it'll be a much smaller bite that we'll have to take to get there if we have to get over there, kind of thing. The rates, kind of to Sam's point, I mean, it's based on kind of a continued 2 to 3% growth in the district, usage kind of staying about where it is per unit, and then and inflation staying at about that 3%. Because there's lots of those variables that can impact. For example, when we had the real rapid growth in 2021, it actually delayed a rate increase because we had so many more customers paying base. So on the downside, Dakota Pacific draws more money, but it would accelerate my revenue projection too. And I haven't built that in yet. So, if inflation, if we have another, you know, run of 9-10% inflation like we did, you know, that would definitely change things on our rate increases too. But that would make sense to people because they'd know everything was getting more expensive. Unfortunately, it doesn't help them pay it, but everything would be getting more expensive.
Operation.
Not debt-wise. That's a good thing because you kind of get your debt locked in and then you're really just moving with your normal variables of growth and inflation and things like that. But knowing what we've committed to and what the rate is on it is at least get you something to build from.
And the extra money we might need to go out to get, that's just a function of scope creep. The original proposal we were shown sounded like we had more than we were asking for more money than what we needed for the project, and now the project costs significantly more money than what we
they're still, and not saying we'll get any of that back. but there's still a lot of contingency in those projects. So I just don't want to go get money until we have someone who's signed on and said, we will do it for this amount.
What was the contingency number for all that in there?
Six. Dropped to 20%.
Which is standard.
Yeah. But if in October, November, when we get to go out to bid and we get a construction contract that says we're 10% high or 10% low, then that'll probably be when we do some, okay, how much are we going to, are we going to, and how much are we going to have to borrow in addition to what we've already secured?
Because we can use that WIFIA of money early on. And yes. It gives you some time during construction to make,
yeah,
to have money for the final payments.
Yeah.
In worst case, another WIFIA alone is possible. Yep.
But
as an option.
Or, yeah, we're just going to our normal either a direct placement with Bank of Utah like we did, like, hey, we need another $2.5-3 million to get this over the, you know, get it done. We're going out and doing a revenue bond that we're looking at doing to replace the loan on this building. So.
But if Dakota comes on, that could pay for it?
Well,
it would be a sizable impact fee.
And yeah, because if $4 million gets added to the impact fee balance, and the treatment plant has is in the IFFP,
it's in the IFFP,
so we could use that money for it to help. So,
so we just wanted
that $4 million.
Well, we did a take off.
Oh, you did
based off like a master plan essentially. If they came in and paid them, check.
So just wanted to revisit this again. We heard you after the last meeting. We're working, you know, with Corolla to keep them on task, on budget. They came back last week and they said, oh, we need to redesign the roof. It's going to be $51,000. Pushed back and said, well, you didn't check what the code was. So
that was the last board meeting.
Yeah, so we're not paying 100% of that cost. So they understand that, you know, we don't have unlimited money.
Yeah.
So we'll continue to do that. We'll continue to keep you updated over the next couple months as we get closer to 90%. So that's all I have on the treatment plant. Each of you should have received an email from the state auditor's office. Ian, I know you have because I've seen your name on the list. Uh-huh. But there is some mandatory training that going to need to take place in April of this year. They've asked for preference of location.
So that's tonight's training.
No, that's separate.
That's right. All we put in was our county.
Yeah, county, and then they're going to...
Name and county.
Yep. And so if you haven't seen that, please check your email and respond. We don't have any more details. Steve, Lisa, and I also received it. I don't have any other details of what the actual training is.
There's a bunch of other people from Summit County on there, so I'm assuming we'll get one.
Like, I didn't get the email, but I see your PDF of the email.
Yeah, I got the email. Yeah. I just assumed that tonight.
It's separate. So you should have received an email from the state auditor.
Yeah.
I bet it's because you just...
Okay.
Probably because of new or whatever.
Yeah.
That may be true.
I just have to spam.
Mike, it looks like maybe they've got an email wrong at the state, so I'll get that fixed with you too, so you get it.
I'll just resend it out with a link. Just
you didn't get it.
Okay. I don't think you got it, Mike, because your email address says MTN Regional.
It's just MT Regional. It says MTN.
I'll forward it back out.
In there.
Yeah, in the email they were trying to send to you.
That's
so
all.
So when does that have to be done by?
Sooner rather than later. So they're trying to come up with dates in April.
We don't know where or...
I think my guess is they'll provide a couple of different locations based on the responses.
Couldn't one of us just fill it out for the board?
Good. Yeah.
Save Mike the trouble.
One email.
I mean, Anna did order his dinner.
Have to use it.
Exactly.
That's all I had, Karen.
Okay, great. Does anyone have any questions on the department updates?
No technology questions, Dave?
I'm here to answer them. Yep, Chris on the other one.
I wanted to give Anna a pat on the back for dropping the number of emails we needed by 80%. That was amazing.
Mostly Kimberly.
So, a lot of work, yeah.
Was that emails we needed for?
Well, in June, people are going to have to pay $1 for
paper.
To get an actual paper bill. Gotcha. So.
Yeah, it's a win-win for sure.
Yeah.
We really haven't had pushback on that.
No. And I was surprised at how many people called and gave us their emails.
Right.
Good.
Okay, and then number 9 is our control board elections. So once a year we have to re-elect everybody, and we have the chair, the vice chair, Audit and Finance Committee Chair, the Finance Committee, which is all of us, Conservation Committee Chair, which is currently you and Mike?
Personnel.
Oh, your personnel.
Just one person. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Joel and Mike were personnel.
Okay, and then, yeah, personnel, and then Andy's the district clerk, and Steve is the treasurer.
And the audit committee is new.
Well, we have a finance committee.
Right, we
currently.
Audit.
Do we have anyone that wants to throw their hat in the ring for chair?
I nominate Karen Wilson for the chair.
I'm honored. See, I knew there was a reason I dressed up tonight.
You do a really great job.
Oh, thanks, guys.
Yeah, unless you want to change scenery, I'd be honored to serve with you more.
Okay, well, so do we have to vote on each of these, or will we just wait until the end?
You need to vote on each.
Okay. So was that officially a motion?
Are they a motion, each one?
You motion nominate somebody, yep. And you get a second. And then if nobody else nominates anyone, you can move to close nominations. And then if you only have one person, that person is appointed by acclamation. And if there's more than one, then you have a vote. You go to the next.
So I think you nominated and I seconded. Is that how that went? I think you said her name first. All right. I'll nominate Karen. I'll second that. We don't need those. Oh, yeah. And Mike moves to close. And we don't need to vote because there's only, well, unless there's any others.
You have to second.
Nomination to close. Motion to close. You just motion to close and it's closed.
Well, you got to have at least a second.
Oh, I'll second that motion.
Okay.
By acclamation.
Well, I'm honored to continue as the chair of the board. And then now we have to go into the vice chair.
I'm currently vice chair. I'm open if somebody else wants to pick that. You know, my travel sometimes had me miss meetings. So if somebody else wanted it, I'd be more than willing to switch to another role for a while. But open to staying in as well.
So is this the situation where I can nominate somebody? Okay. So I would like to nominate Ian.
Second.
Is there anyone else that would like to throw out a nomination?
Motion to close nominations.
Yep.
Okay. So. Then we have the Audit and Finance Committee Chair. And this is new? Or this
we have a finance committee, which there is a chair, and then the entire board makes up the rest of the finance committee. But
oh, gotcha.
But we don't have an audit committee. We don't have it in place yet because we don't have the policies approved. So that is more of a two-person. So we can't really vote on it right now because it's not currently in place. But there is a finance committee.
Okay. Which everyone will...
There just needs to be a chair. So we need to elect a chair of the finance committee. And normally that's been you. But it's the whole board.
Okay. I think you have the natural background for that. Although, yeah. Bill, I don't remember your background.
Yes, I mean, as far as like finance, it's, well, I always thought it was like the new guy has to do something. I'm not surprised to maybe hear, but
other option.
Yeah. But you're currently the.
Yes, because I'm CPA and you guys are all engineers.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking.
Okay, so your background's more not
engineering. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
It's numbers, not dollar signs.
Yeah.
Got it. Well, that's what we might say.
Totally makes sense. I nominate Karen Wilson for finance chair.
I'll second.
Okay. Perfect. Anyone like to close the nomination?
I'll close the nomination. Close the nominations. Use that for budget.
You're keeping track of all the Santa.
And recording it too.
She's kind of fast.
Okay. And then everyone's on the finance committee. Do we still need to vote on that?
Yeah.
Okay. And then we have the conservation committee chair, which is currently Corey.
Be happy with that.
You know, it's an opportunity to hang out with Sam and Jess once a year. Every 5 years.
Yep.
Once a year.
This year. This year could be interesting.
You're going to get deputized to go to houses.
I'm going to go to my HOA and tell them to put water in the lawn park.
I'll nominate Corey for conservation chair.
Yay.
Second.
Motion to close nominations.
Okay.
I'll be a second to that. I'll second.
And then, so the conservation committee is just Corey, or is there actually a committee?
No, it's just Corey.
It's just in one person.
Okay, and then now we have the two board members for the personnel committee.
I'd like to nominate Joel Fine.
The HR ex-board member.
He was so good. He was my partner. I'm the other.
Yeah. Tim Doherty was really good at it.
Yeah. This committee doesn't have a chair, just two members?
It just has two members. Okay.
I'll continue to serve.
Okay.
I'll nominate Mike Kobe.
Second that.
Board member.
And then board member two. Bill, would you have any interest in being on the personnel committee?
Sure.
Okay, I would like to nominate Bill.
Second that.
Close nominations.
Okay. All right. So, great.
You're in. Okay.
And then Andy's already the district clerk, and Steve's already the treasurer. So, we get through that in 15 minutes. Okay, and now the part we've all been waiting for.
Yeah.
Dave Thomas forgot. Will.
We're going to adjourn?
the annual administrative control board training. I can't wait to see some new memes.
You want to drive, Dave? I'm not.
Yeah.
Just the board members? Everyone
has. I think we're required to be take the training too.
I'm locked in.
We'll go quick. So we're going to talk a little bit about special districts, the role that you all have, the role Andy has, open meetings, and liability and immunity.
We get extra points if we find new things on slides.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it doesn't update our web, our logo.
We'll send it to you.
So the county has 13 dependent districts and 13 independent districts. Summit County has more districts than any other county in the state, partly because the Snyderville Basin is the biggest city in the county by a lot. There are about 28,000 people in the unincorporated Snyderville Basin. There's only 9,000 people in Park City. In fact, there's more people in the basin than there is in the rest of the county in all the cities together. As a result of that, there is a proliferation of special districts because special districts provide municipal services. And that was the way counties could provide municipal services without people being in the city. And they didn't want to be in a Snyderville basin city, one, because they lose their zip code and they want to be in Park City. And secondly, they would have a significant tax increase. So as a result, all these special districts and Mountain Regional is one of them.
That kept our taxes lower?
That kept your taxes lower.
They used to be close to 1%, probably 20 years ago. So, definitely.
Special service districts are a specific class of special district. And you know, basically, the services, there's water service, you can have sewer, you can have cemetery, mineral lease, transportation, recreation park. Ones that I've highlighted are the big ones that the county has. Water, recreation, fire protection are the biggest ones. The county has not done a garbage collection disposal one, although they thought about it. All of these districts, special service districts, are dependent districts. So the difference between a dependent district and an independent district is dependent districts have administrative control boards who have delegated authority from the county legislative body. And the county legislative body is your governing body. It's the reason why you keep making recommendations to the governing body. The governing body passes some things delegated to you and some things they reserve for themselves. An independent district is a district that is created by the county, but once it's created, it's kind of on its own. And its governing board is a board of trustees. A lot of times, the county will create that district with an elected board of trustees. Sometimes not. The cemetery districts are still appointed. They are independent districts. In terms of the delegation of powers to you and to Andy as your executive officer, just so you know, the dependent districts have to comply with the local district act, fiscal procedures for local districts that you're budgeting, audit reports, personnel management, requiring a merit system, and a special provision that talks about fees and charges and the fact that you have to have a public hearing before you can impose them. And you're subject to the Utah Procurement Code, which is different than cities and counties. There are certain non-delegable duties, duties which the governing body, county council, is prohibited by statute from delegating. One is annexations. That's why all the annexations go to the council. There are certain public works contracts that the county council could designate as part of your governing ordinance that would require certain different bid and notice requirements for construction. The county council has never done that. They could. They have the power to impose those kinds of restrictions on you over and above the Utah Procurement Code. Property taxation goes through the council anytime you do bonding. Assessments and interim warrants, you guys don't really deal with that or with Board of Equalization because you don't have an assessment area right now. This is your governing body, County Council. The County Council appoints and removes you as Administrative Control Board members. There is one exception, Park City Fire District. When it was formed, one member could be appointed by the Park City Council. The council consents to the hire and discharge of the executive officer, so Andy, but they rely upon you all and your recommendations. You're required to have interlocal agreement with the county for legal services. That's what's going to come up at the end of the year. There are certain powers that they have not delegated to any of their special service districts or one or two of them. And these are kind of specialized areas. One is personnel. However, once they took back personnel to the council, they then issued a letter of authorization, which basically gives you the authority to do all the personnel stuff. And all it really says is, hey, before you have a big personnel action, like you're going to discharge someone, you need to let the county HR director, David Warnock, know. Usually, he'll know because as part of the ILA with legal services, you're dealing with one of my HR attorneys, and David Warnock's going to know for that attorney. Because those attorneys handle all the HR for all the districts and for the county. Budget, the council, many years ago, 10 years ago, allowed its special districts to approve their own budgets. They took that back. Basically, around the same time, it's been like 15 years, around the same time that the county went to a new option form of government. Bylaws, policies, procedures, and regulations. That's one area that I think I mentioned to Anna, I've mentioned it to other executives, is an area that you might attempt to see if the council will give up some of that. Last time, when it came before the council, a year and a half ago, it kind of went down in flames. But I think it's because it was kind of an all or nothing. The Park City Fire District was talking about taking back, you know, budgeting power as well as the bylaws, policies, procedures, regulations. And it was just a bridge too far. So that's something you might want to keep your eye on in the future. Eminent domain, I don't see the council delegating that to any of the districts. With real property, this is only for the recreation district. And is derived out of the fact that acquiring real property, they're generally acquiring it with bond money, and it's usually open space bond money that went through the county council, and so the county council wants a say in what gets bought. There is, in this legislative session, a new provision that talks about the disposition of real property that's going to affect the district. It's a new statute. It used to be that cities and counties would have to designate properties that are significant real property. And if it was designated significant real property, you had to have a 14-day notice and a public hearing before you could dispose of the real property asset. The new law basically went into a different section of the code. It's not the city or the county section. It's Title 11. That's where your impact fees and a number of other things are. And they put this in to make it applicable to counties, cities, and special districts. And that is, if you're going to dispose of any real property that has a value of over $500,000, you're going to have to, one, put it on your website for 45 days so that it's published out there that you're disposing of this piece of property and invite other individuals to bid on it if they want. Secondly, you have to post it, so you have to put a sign on the property, and the sign has to tell them who they can contact at your special service district office to find out more information about the sale of the property. And then lastly, you have to state that you're selling the property in public deed. So those are the three requirements now that's applicable to city, county, and all the special service districts. We'll see how this kind of plays out. One of the things that at least the legislator was interested in doing was he didn't really like public-private partnerships and venture, joint ventures. And this may have an impact on future joint ventures between local government and whether it's developers or other property owners. And it may have a negative consequence on affordable housing. So, don't know, when the after effects of the bill start to come about. Not sure what'll happen. So you all know, just kind of offhand, with affordable housing, the tax credit project now require or proposed to require that if a local government is going to get involved in a tax credit project, they automatically have to bring on a developer, a private developer. And the private developer has to have experience in tax credits and doing those projects. Problem is, usually the local government is coming to the table and they have the land, and the developer will have the experience. And I'm not sure how a joint venture is going to work out if you're basically entertaining other bids for 45 days and you're publicizing beginning before you've really had any discussions for the joint venture. So not sure how it's all going to work out. But anyway, there you go. Direct litigation, if you settle, that has to be approved by the county council. And that's a remnant of the Summit Water lawsuit. Funding and financing. Generally, districts are funded as fee-for-service. You mentioned you've got to have a public hearing. And you, as the district control board, hold that public hearing. And you have the authority to set fee. property taxes. Usually there's an election that's required. Once you have the election, you set an upper rate. There's no limitation, unlike independent districts. Independent districts have statutory rate caps. Special service districts do not, and that's as a result of the fact that the governing body is elected legislative body. Your district does not have a tax rate. You haven't had an election. There are districts that have. The Mason Rec has. Both of the fire districts, there's special service districts have. Impact fees.
Do you know why that was beneficial to them?
Basin Rec?
Yeah.
Or fire? Fire can't really survive deeper service, especially because of the capital improvements. There are some recreation districts that do survive fee base, but the Snurville Basin Rec, when the Snurville Basin Rec started going out and doing large open space ponds, and then they had, and once you buy property as open space, all of a sudden you have maintenance responsibilities behind that. And a lot of the things that the Basin Rec did are non-fee based. So all your trail systems are free, and they have to maintain all the trail systems. And so as a result of that, they decided to go forward in election. General obligation bonds also require an election if you can do that. That's how they did the open space bonds, the geo bonds. Lease revenue bonds. Those are bonds that are over $10 million now require a public hearing. I think the WIFIA is not a true lease revenue bond because of how it worked out. It's more, even though we're kind of selling bonds, we're kind of not, because we're just selling them to the federal government. But if you go out and you're short $10 million on the project, and you're going to go out not with you, but you're going to go out, whether it's Zions Bank or some other bank, and issue some kind of a bond, you would be required to have a public hearing. You don't have to worry about truth in taxation since you don't levy a property tax. The executive officer, Andy, these are the roles that he plays. We'll quickly go through them. He supervises all the department heads and district officers. And when I'm subbing for Chris, I guess I'm under you. Approves the district personnel actions, works with our attorneys on that, controls and directs prosecution, defense, and settlement of all civil lawsuits, recognizing that that's different from Mountain Regional, directs prosecution, defense, and settlement of civil lawsuits, that's good to the county council, issues executive orders, keeps the board updated on all the matters, understanding that your SOPs, so not your general rules and regulations, but you may have some internal SOPs. Those are actually a form of executive order that doesn't have to go to the council. Financial role, he's your purchasing agent, although we can delegate that. Executes contracts, presents the budget to you. He's your risk manager, interface with Utah Local Governments Trust, applies for grants, approves expenditures and warrants up to whatever amount you've set in your personnel policy or other procurement policy. asset manager role over all the district facilities, assets, real property, develops capital facilities plan approved by you, and that's approved by the county council. The county council approves the capital facilities plan and the impact fee facilities plan. But you, for impact fees, you hold the public hearing for the fee itself, and you impose the fee. Purchase and dispose of real and personal property. Liaison role with all the county and cities and other districts, special service district association, public relations officer, but you can always use the county's PIO if you need one. Regulatory role, enforces compliance with all your rules and regulations, signs off on the subdivision plats, custodian of your minutes, prepares those rules, regulations, and policies, procedures for your consideration as you give recommendations to the council, resolves complaints, which is always a big job, prepares organization master plans, applies with grandma, appoints somebody to be the grandma officer, ensures that Open Meetings Act training takes place, and renews your annual registration with Lieutenant Governor. Your role as the control board. Utah State Governor has that little manual for local and special service districts. I mean, it's nice resource. Doesn't really get into a lot, but at least it gives you a general overview. Regulatory role. You recommend the policies and procedures to the council. You can sit as an appellate authority on certain policies and procedures, and recommends organization master plan to the county council, ends this training. Financial role, recommends the annual district budget, recommend your capital facilities plan, recommend tax levies if you're going to go that route, conduct financial performance audit at your new audit finance committee, exercises financial oversight of the district. That's the process where you're looking at all the cash disbursements each board meeting and going through and asking questions about it. If you're going to do bonding, we have to do a parameters resolution. You make a recommendation to the county council as to the parameters of what that bond would be. As I mentioned, you impose impact fees. You set the district fee structure through the budget process, but you hold the public hearing and you make final decision on fees. You can also approve how the funds are invested that you have through the Money Management Act, asking your treasurer, you know, how he's holding the money. It used to be that, Public Treasurer Investment Fund. It used to be that was the equivalent of throwing your money under a mattress. It's actually done fairly well over the last few years.
They did the county side of the deal loan.
They did.
Because that didn't fall under Andy's.
Yeah, the chair of the council can assign with the loan. Your supervisory role, you can veto hiring decisions that Andy makes. You can veto his executive orders. You conduct his performance evaluation. With the advice and consent of the county council, you appoint and discharge your general manager. You serve as an appellate body on personnel actions. You can actually use the county's Career Service Council, which is actually becoming an administrative law judge position. What's important is that you do not direct individual employees of the district. You go through Andy. So if you have a problem with Steve because you think he's embezzling money, You don't confront Steve. You go to Andy. If you have a problem with the IT, you don't call me. you go to Andy. And Andy then decides how he's gonna deal with things. Governing body role, you're the principal policymaker of the district. You act as an oversight capacity on everything. Remember that, you take votes. Usually you're unanimous, but you haven't always been unanimous on everything. Recognize that the board expresses itself through majority vote. We have a quorum present, and you're complying with the Open Meetings Act. And if you're on the losing side of a vote, you can tell the press that, what your decision was, that you disagreed. Make sure they understand that, your dissenting vote was a dissenting vote. Make sure they understand what the actual vote of the board is. The board acts through that majority. Open Meetings Act will become more and more apparent why this is continuing to be an important thing. The whole idea of the Open Meetings Act is transparency. We want to do things in public, deliberations openly, take our actions openly, so people can see their government in action. As a result of that, we have to post a notice of when we're going to have a meeting. It's got to be 24 hours in advance, has to include an agenda. The agenda has to have date, time, and place in the meeting. That agenda is posted to the Utah Public Notice website. It's also posted on the district's website and in a public location within the district, usually at the district office. You publish an annual meeting schedule. Doesn't mean that these are the only meetings you're going to have, but at least it gives the public an idea of when you're going to be meeting on a fairly regular basis. I noted that your notice has to include an agenda. It has date, time, and place. Something that's important is the agenda itself has items that are going to be discussed or actions going to be taken. You have to have what's called reasonable specificity with regard to those items to put people on notice of what you're actually doing. So you can't have a meeting that just says new business. You have to have something specific and a consideration of approval of impact fees or whatever it might be. Public body may not take final action on a topic in an open meeting unless the topic is listed under the agenda item and included with the required advance public notice. This becomes important because during the course of a meeting, there may be things that come up and are discussed that are tangential to something else that's not an agenda item. And you just have to recognize that you can't get carried away and take a final action on it if it's not actually on the agenda. So what happens if something is raised, whether by the public or just another board member? At the discretion of the chair, you can have a discussion on it, even if it wasn't on the agenda, but you cannot take any action on it. Electronic meetings, these really came to the forefront during COVID. Generally, you have to have a policy, and you've got a policy on electronic meetings. You have to have an anchor location. That's a physical location where the public can come to see the meeting. So even if you were to have a completely electronic meeting where all of you were basically on your computers at home, there needs to be a physical site where people can come and view everything. That's the anchor location. You can only get rid of the anchor location under certain parameters, and, you know, think COVID. That's basically where health and safety issues come up. Those are the only times you can dispense with an anchor location. You, when you're meeting, you have to have a quorum present. You have to have a quorum present every time you vote. A quorum means a simple majority of your membership. So for you all, the quorum is 3. A couple of years ago, the legislature decided to mix it up a little bit, and they decided to redefine what a meeting is. So this is what they say. Meeting's a gathering of the public body, that's of your board, with a quorum presence, 3, that is convened by an individual. And the individual is the chair, pursuant to your bylaws. And that's because the chair has the authority to convene the public body and do so in a manner provided by law. And she would do it with the express purpose of receiving public comment or to deliberate about a matter or to take action. Now you might think this, well, of course, that's a meeting. Well, what happens if you have a quorum present of 3 of you and the chair does not officially convene the meeting? Technically, you don't have a meeting. So, if you don't have a meeting, 3 of you can be discussing all sorts of stuff outside of the Open Meetings Act. And you might say, well, you know, that's a big loophole. Well, it is, and we'll get to how they close that loophole in a minute. But just to give you an idea of the types of meetings that have to be noticed, traditional meetings like this, workshops, executive sessions, although with executive sessions, you can always go into an executive or closed session from an open session, even if it's not on the agenda. Site visits, traveling tours. So here's the closing of the loophole. Okay, you're not in a meeting. So you've got a quorum present. You haven't been convened. However, if you act in a concerted and a deliberate way to predetermine an action, then you violate the Open Meetings Act. And generally, when you start talking about business with 3 of you present, the line when you start deliberating is really fuzzy. And it's very easy to go over the line. So I always advise you guys, if 3 of you are going to meet on a matter of business with the district, it needs to be agendaed, it needs to be noticed as a meeting. Even if technically Open Meetings Act says, well, it's not a meeting, because you could get caught in this, and we'll discuss liability and what this might mean in a little bit.
And Andy counts as part of that?
Like, no.
It doesn't. Okay, it's just board members.
Just board members.
Okay. So 2 of us can go to lunch with you.
Yep. Discussions during a meeting. Don't Zoom chat. Don't text back and forth during our meetings. Don't email. Say it so that it's on the record. It's the whole idea about the transparency, that people know what we're doing. Emails and texts. Information dissemination is different from discussion. If you want to provide information to all the board members, that's fine, but nobody can respond to all the board members. So, Ian, if you send an informational item to all the board members and somebody wants to comment on that, they need to respond only to you, not to the entire board. Because if you respond to the entire board, that could be an open meeting act violation.
So, does that include dinner?
Yes.
No, because you're responding to Anna.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, not all.
Okay. Anyway, I don't think anybody's going to jump on you for that, but
no, that's you never a good
know.
One.
Never know. Yeah. Emergency meeting. Unforeseen circumstances, you can call an emergency meeting and you give the best notice practically. Generally, you need to make an attempt to notify all the board members, and at least a majority of the board members must approve of the meeting, and you set the time and place and what the topic is. Barely see this one. I have to look at this presentation. Either that or it's
an IT problem.
It's an IT problem, you know. And obviously, that's my problem. You can notice a closed meeting in advance, or as I said, you can always go into a closed meeting from an open meeting. But you have to close it for only one of the statutory purposes. And you have to take a vote, and the vote has to be a two-thirds majority vote. So four of the five of you would need to vote in favor of going into a closed session. So the procedure is you got your quorum present, a motion is made to close, you have to say the specific statutory reason, there's a roll call vote, two-thirds have to vote in favor of closing the meeting. That's two-thirds of the individuals who are present. So if there are only three of you present, two of you have to vote in favor. There are record-keeping, recording, affidavit requirements, depending upon what you're closing it for. And then once you're done, you adjourn and return to the open meeting.
So if there are three people present, two people vote yes, one person votes no, that one person decides not to join the meeting, you don't have a quorum in that session. So yep. So that kills it.
Yep. But the two people could still then meet because there's only two of them. It's not an open meeting. Doesn't violate doing these. They can't take any action. They can talk. So here's kind of a quick reference guide. One of the reasons you can close a meeting is discuss litigation. You have to record it. You don't have to have the chair sign an affidavit. Personnel, when you're discussing the character, professional competence, or physical or mental health of an individual, you do not have to record that closed meeting, but the chair has to sign an affidavit that says, we closed the meeting for this purpose. Property acquisition, again, you have to record that. No affidavit. Security. So if you're talking about the deployment of security systems and devices, you can close it for that. You do not have to record the meeting. But again, you have to have the chair sign an affidavit that we closed it for security. You're recording these closed meetings, but they're a protected record under the Government and Records and Access Management Act, which means they're not released. You can't grab out of them. They can only be released as a result of a lawsuit that would be filed, and it would be disclosed if somebody were asserting that you had an illegal closed meeting. As part of that litigation, the court would ask for the recording, and you would give the recording just to the judge. The judge would review it. It's called in camera, just the judge, and then the judge would decide whether it's an appropriate closed meeting or not. If it's an appropriate, it's an appropriate closed meeting, he just gives you back the recording. If it's not an appropriate closed meeting, then it's provided to the plaintiff. What is forbidden during the closed meeting? You can't actually make a decision during the closed meeting. You have to come out and be on the record to make an actual decision. You can't interview a person to fill an elected position. That, when we say elected position, we're talking about elected in the election code sense. So that's not going to really apply to you all. Can't take final actions. I already said that. Be careful not to have the closed meeting sway off course. Usually I will mention something if we're becoming far afield. Or somebody else, Andy's pretty good about saying when we're far afield from what we are supposed to be talking about in a closed meeting. Closed meetings do not have to be closed. I mean, you don't have to have a closed meeting. It's always discretionary. Nothing requires you to close the meeting. But there are actually good reasons why certain things you're probably not going to want to have an open meeting. One of them, property acquisition. You're deciding basically what your strategy is, what you're going to offer, and what you would go up to. Obviously, if you have that in public, that would kind of blow your entire strategy, and you wouldn't get a very good deal. So there are practical reasons why you go into a closed meeting. Records of open meetings, you have to keep written minutes as well as a recording. We talked about this, records of closed meetings. You only record the closed meeting portion. The written minutes only disclose what you went in for and who voted, time, place, who is present. And as I mentioned, for personnel and security, you don't make a recording. Maybe. There we go. Enforcement. My office enforces it. The Attorney General has a special unit that they have as well. Anyone who's denied a right by some action that's taken at a meeting that violates the Open Meetings Act has the ability to file a lawsuit. Courts may order compliance or enjoin violations of the Open Meetings Act, and you can get attorney's fees. Non-criminal remedies, if you violate the Open Meetings Act, generally speaking, any action you take in violation of the Open Meetings Act is voidable. So the action is valid until somebody challenges it. But if you know there's a violation, a lot of times you can cure the violation by going through the open meetings process and putting it on an agenda and having a revote on it. So you can ratify it, and that cures the Open Meetings Act violation. If somebody's going to challenge your action for violation of the Open Meetings Act, you have to do it within 90 days. If it is on a bonding matter, it's 30 days. And litigation costs, when the county sued Hideout, for example, we sued them for, among other things, Open Meetings Act violation. And we got our attorney's fees for it. If you intentionally violate the Open Meetings Act, there are some criminal penalties. Class B misdemeanor, 6 months, $1,000 fine. The presiding officer of the public body, in this case Karen, makes sure that everybody receives Open Meetings Act training. Common violations, closed meeting violations without voting first, conducting a closed meeting for reasons other than under the Open Meetings Act, taking an action in the closed meeting, failing to properly notice a public meeting, is an open meeting, or where you don't have reasonable specificity of what your action items are. Although it's not a specific violation of the Act, there are always potential for due process violations when you allow public comment on something that's like a pending application before you. And that's because whoever the applicant is should have been provided notice so that they could go to the meeting and respond. Generally, that never applies to the special districts, but it does apply to cities and counties a lot, especially on land use matters. Some of the parting tips, remember 24 hours notice, be specific on your agendas. When you come out of a closed meeting, you can't just simply say, hey, we're going to take an action on what happened in the closed meeting. You have to actually say what the action is. You have to be specific. Closed for only statutory purposes. Don't text during meetings. Don't have meetings outside the notice meetings. Even though the legislature kind of says you can, I advise against it. Always err on the side of transparency. You can always call our office if you have a question. And you're supposed to certify to your chair that you've had this meeting, or this training. And that leads to liability and immunity. There are two questions that you need to pull apart. One is immunity. Can I be held personally liable for the decisions that I make as a board member? And then indemnification, not determining whether or not you have immunity, but whether I have immunity or not, will the district defend me and cover any personal liability that I have? There's something called absolute immunity. It's for legislative action. The Supreme Court has said the time and energy required to defend against a lawsuit are particularly concerned at the local level where the part-time citizen legislator remains commonplace, and the threat of liability may significantly deter service in local government, where prestige and pecuniary rewards may pale in comparison to the threat of civil liability. As a result of that, if you're acting under a legislative hat, you have absolute immunity, and it's easy for me to get everybody dismissed from the case. Qualified immunity applies to administrative decisions and actions. And this is where you only receive this kind of qualified immunity as an affirmative defense to a lawsuit, where an official, you don't get it if you have violated a clearly established right. So as long as you're not violating a clearly established right, then you're going to have qualified immunity. And we'll talk in a minute what that means. Generally, what me and my office do is we try to give you some legal advice where you, let's see if we even, there we go. Where we give you some guardrails on how you make decisions. Stay within the guardrails. As long as you stay in the guardrails, as long as you stay in your own lane, then whatever decision you make you're not going to violate a clearly established right. And that's because you have good faith reliance on legal counsel. It's a safe harbor rule. Even if I'm wrong and you end up violating a clearly established right, as long as you were following my advice and staying within those guardrails, you still have qualified immunity. Now, can you tell whether you're making a legislative decision or administrative decision? Always cast it as, are you creating something legislative? Or are you applying something administrative? Because if it's creating, you have absolute immunity. If you're applying, it means all within the guardrails, you have qualified immunity. So, what hat are you wearing? If you're approving the budget, you're wearing your legislative hat, giving your recommendations, policies, all those things. If you were levying a tax, all those things are legislative, absolute immunity. Qualified immunity, administrative, you're applying something to specific property or person, or other ministerial acts, contract negotiations or approval, buying, selling property, personnel decisions. Those are the kinds of things where qualified immunity comes into play. Executive orders, that's also administrative.
What are annexations?
Annexations are legislative. You have absolute immunity. So that's immunity. Indemnification is different. Indemnification basically says, as long as you're operating within the scope of your office and you're not acting with malice, the government is going to defend you. Mountain Regional will defend you, and their insurance carrier will defend you. And even if you're found to be liable and you don't have qualified immunities, the district and its insurance company will pay for it. So indemnification and immunity are different but related. It's best to have immunity, but it's also good to have indemnification because the cost of litigating a lot of times is the penalty for a plaintiff if they think that you've wronged them. Even if you think you're right, even if you think you have qualified immunity, it costs a lot of money to litigate. And having indemnification from the district, where the district's going to defend you, the district's going to present your absolute or qualified immunity to the court, that's the best way. So the problem is this thing called malice. Those of you who have seen this before know that malice is probably not what you actually think, because it's legal malice. It's a legal term of art. And it basically is if you're doing something with the intent to inflict injury, you might think, well, when would that happen? Primarily, it's the Open Meetings Act. The Open Meetings Act, it's easy to do something intentional where an injury to somebody is foreseeable. And as a result of that, it's imparted to you as malice so that you don't get indemnification from the district. I'll give you the same example I've given in the past. Way back when, in the early 1990s, I had one planning commission, and it was just a group of good old boys sitting around a table. They were in Colville, and it was the end of the planning commission night, and their good buddy came in and said to him, "Hey, I realize you guys are about ready to leave." They're just chewing the fat. He goes, "But hey, I want to do X. I'm going to do this thing I want to put a loading facility, you know, just on the railroad here in Echo. And is that okay? You get anybody have a problem with that? Looked around the room, they go, no, we think that's fine. So you would think nothing big. Problem is that wasn't on the agenda. They made an official action that was relied upon by this individual, and that turned into a 20-year lawsuit. Violation of the Open Meetings Act, and technically, none of those individuals would have been covered by the district's or the county's insurance. Willfully violating the law is another way to lose your qualified immunity, also lose indemnification. When you violate a clearly established right, this comes up when you decide you're not going to follow the advice of your legal counsel and you're going to go outside the guardrails. Once you go outside the guardrails, you're on your own. I've had clients in the past who thought they were pocket attorneys and they thought they knew what the law was and they didn't take legal advice. They acted outside of it and they got personally sued. And yeah, that becomes problematic. This is why we have the safe harbor. Generally, when you get sued for damages, individuals on boards and commissions, it's under this federal act, the Ku Klux Klan Act, the 1983 Civil Rights case. Governmental Immunity Act is not applicable. It's any time a person acting under the color of state law deprives someone of their rights secured by the United States Constitution. Constitution or federal law. And one of the rare cases where punitive damages could be awarded against a public official. Lastly, ethics. Conflicts of interest. Understand that when we talk about conflicts of interest, legal conflicts, we're talking about monetary or familial relationships. You know, the idea that you guys are approving a contract and you're going to personally benefit monetarily from the contract. Or the contract is with your spouse or with your child. Those are the cases where you actually have an actual conflict of interest, where you disclose it in a public meeting and you recuse yourself from any decision making on that matter. There are other conflicts that are not technically legal conflicts of interest. We're going to make a decision and it's going to affect my neighbor or a really good friend of mine. You should probably disclose that, but you can still vote on it and take action. Remember not to take bribes. You can take a non-cash gift with a value of $50 or less. I'm not sure what $50 or less will buy you anymore. It used to be that they put this in for a round of golf. But I'm not sure you could do a round of golf for $50 anymore. They've never changed it.
Is that like once a year or how often?
It's a one-time for one-time event. Although don't do what the planning staff did. They got a whole case of wine from a developer, and they were going, well, each one of these is under $50. No, it's not the way it works. No nepotism. Board members can't be employees of the district. Remember to fill out your annual disclosure. That's become a really big thing in the legislature. I think that's it. Questions? I know that was titillating, but
yes,
you know,
gets more riveting every year.
Every year. I'll make changes based on what the governor signed into law this year. Yep.
Yes, thank you, Dave.
Pressure every
yeah.
year.
Yeah.
Never had it, so
that's
good.
I learned stuff. We're taking control back.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we are on to number 11. Would anybody like to make a motion to adjourn?
I'll make a motion to adjourn. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. We are adjourned at 8:26.